What's up, Brendan?
The sky, Alan.
The Not a Thing podcast is also up and running for episode 214 on our march to, did we figure out 215? Is
215, yes.
215. So in theory, next week or whenever the next time we record, which hopefully will be next week, will be awesome. Not that this week is not awesome. This week is just the regular level of awesome around the Not a Thing podcast. if you would like to join us on our awesome journey of the Not a Thing podcast, please do. You can tweet at us, post things on Facebook, go to the podcast website at notathingpodcast.com and leave a comment on the show notes, which we post every week, where we talk about all the things and not things that we talk about on the show. If you have a suggestion for that, or if you want to be a guest or a sponsor, I don't know, you could be our first one. It would be awesome. But we're going to jump into things with a couple updates. The first one is an update on the Star Trek Axanar fan film situation. So we talked about it a couple weeks ago in insert episode here regarding the prelude to Axanar, which was their 20-minute kind of prequel fan film that got, you know, Paramount all up in arms. Apparently, and I didn't know this, they have published, or maybe it was just always internal and now they've published it. But there are guidelines around fan fiction for Star Trek, and you can make a fan film, but it can't have any characters or trademarked things or costumes or names of ships or sets or anything that that they have copyright access to. So this being a 20-minute film, it kind of raised some ears, and the fact that it was kickstarted for over $1 million also got like all the lawyers involved, and they had a cease and desist. There was some back and forth. A couple weeks ago, a judge decided it should go to trial, and then just this last week, the folks behind the fan film settled out of court to avoid all the trial nonsense, and it's a bummer. I guess they have committed to, instead of doing a feature-length thing, they are going to do the maximum amount that fan film guideline allows, which is you can do a 15-minute film, but the story, the overall story, cannot be longer than 30 minutes. So essentially you're locked into two episodes or two 15-minute episodes, and that's what they're going to do to, you know, as fans of Star Trek. And I think as fans of Star Trek, I think it's a bummer that Star Trek is doing that. Or rather, Paramount, the license holders of Star Trek, are doing that. I think it does is squash the idea of kind of enjoying a thing and wanting to create stuff in that world. Especially because Paramount has also announced that they are delaying their new Star Trek. So not only are we not going to get the Star Trek fan film that a bunch of people kickstarted, we're not going to get the Star Trek new series on TV. I mean, we weren't going to get it on TV, as it were, anyway. It's going to CBS's still not existent streaming channel, I think. But it, rather than like terrestrial over-the-air TV or even cable TV, it's going to be exclusively streamed. Star Trek Discovery, it was announced sometime last year, and it was supposed to start in January, and then there was a delay, and it was supposed to start in May, and now who knows? There's a big old question mark on the calendar for that one. A bunch of people are saying it's because one of the leads in it is also on The Walking Dead, and they're not sure if that person's going to be able to make, you know, filming commitments and stuff like that. I mean, it's The Walking Dead. They can just kill them off and it would be easy.
They do it all the time.
But I think they even released, or rather, I think the composer released a kind of a test theme song thing, or it was leaked. I feel like it was officially, released, or rather the composer, you know, released it, whether that was, whether that's like official or not, I don't know, because it wasn't finished, but, it sounds very, DS9 in that it sounds kind of spacey dreamy, but it does have a bit of a, like kind of a bit more flow when it kicks in. So it doesn't sound, you know, as super spacey as the DS9 theme. It's sort of similar to the Voyager theme.
As long as it doesn't sound like that piece of shit they had in front of Enterprise.
Right. Exactly. My thoughts exactly.
It has not been long enough.
But Star Trek Discovery apparently not coming out this May. We'll see when it comes out.
They also lost their showrunner.
Yeah.
So they had to bring in other people, which is too bad because Brian Fuller knows how to make a good TV show.
Yeah. Oh, I think he is related to American Gods.
Oh.
If I'm remembering right. I think that's why he had to drop out. Which is fine by me, because I really want to see that too. But I don't know. I think Star Trek hasn't been on the air on TV since Enterprise. And that was, it was both a long time ago and not long enough. I think they have to do something kind of different and interesting with the show, which is why I was kind of depressed when they announced that they have cast someone to play Sarek on the show. So they're not straying too far from the bounds of how Star Trek works. It is at least in the same timeline as the original series in Next Generation, and they are not going the way of the new movies.
The Kelvin timeline?
I think it's sad that there's a name for it. But whatever. Star Trek. I think it's still a thing. It should still continue to be a thing.
I think the world needs Star Trek now more than ever. I don't want to live on Fury Road.
Well, we're going to move away from kind of fanciful pursuits and right into reality. Western Union, the long-standing kind of money sending and remittance kind of thing that amazingly is still around in the age of like PayPal and Bitcoin and stuff like that. It's still good for sending money. Apparently, if you're a money laundering person or creating fraudulent accounts and committing kind of fraud and other various things. So the Western Union was hit with a lawsuit, I think, and they are settling to the tune of, I think it's $586 million in saying that they did not have appropriate protections nor policies that would prevent it from being used in money laundering and fraud kinds of things. So apparently people were using it to launder money, which, I mean, the only reason to do that is essentially to dodge taxes and stuff like that. But they were somehow using Western Union to do so, and it was found that numerous Western Union employees were doing this to get a cut of said money. So it was widespread enough that there was a pattern, you know, similar to that the thing with Wells Fargo a little while ago. And again, $586 million in, you know, the grand scheme of things for a company like like Western Union, is probably not that much money. Similarly with the fine with Wells Fargo. So it's one of those things where it's like, you want them to like pay, but they do have a lot of money that a lot of people have and are tied to a lot of kinds of material things. I think I read somewhere that I think it was the Attorney General under Obama, who knows what's going to happen now, but the Attorney General said something like, you know, they want to go after big banks and things like this for corruption and other crimes, but you know, it's not that they're too big to fail. It's more like if they were fined, it would actually have an effect on the economy, which blows because no one should be above the law. But at least in this case, Western Union's being held to the tune of $586 million. Hopefully they put in some controls about what employees should and shouldn't do and stuff like that. I think it's funny that that company's still around, but it's also funny that you know, they're being used for money laundering, which is one of the like oldest things that you could use a bank for.
Also, duh. It was interesting that one fifth of their workforce now is doing compliance related stuff.
Yeah.
That's you know, you're in a weird industry when a fifth of your employees are making sure your other employees aren't doing illegal things.
Yeah.
That's not sketchy at all.
No, I'm sure it's fine. we're going to move over to something that is, you know, also sketchy, which is the airline industry. So the airline industry has been moving towards lower fares, sort of, and trying to compete with each other on how to do that best. You know, there are different models, like Southwest's model is to, you know, not have people choose seats, or rather have people choose seats live as as it comes out, rather than having the seats guaranteed.
Fly in the Thunderdome.
Yeah. Airlines like Spirit and Frontier, kind of nickel and dime you for all the different things that you can use on a plane, or and then American Airlines, one of the bigger players in the industry, is announcing Economy Basic, and they're this model, the way it works is you get the absolute lowest fare that they can offer. It's the absolute lowest fare. They don't say by how much, but it's definitely going to be lower than any of their advertised fares. And the way they can do this is that if you buy that fare, you are you're guaranteed a seat, but you have to board last. And you don't get to pick where you sit. They assign that to you when you get up to the gate. Also, you don't get to use an overhead bin. You can only use the under seat space for your personal item. You could still check bags, and you would still earn, you know, frequent flyer miles. So at least that's something. But what this looks like to me anyway is they're just trying to stuff as many people into the plane as they can. And if you want to be one of those people, then you can pay a little less than everybody else does. But it's like, what is it? It's like getting the last group of Southwest Airlines, in my opinion.
Nobody wants that.
It's all middle seats. And
let's just call this American Airlines a middle seat.
Yeah. I flew recently, and on my outbound flight, I had the window seat, and on the inbound flight, I had an aisle. And I mistakenly thought that the seats, the under seat storage was the same. You know, between those seats, and it's not. On the aisle, for whatever reason, And I'm sure there is a reason. I mean, I'm mostly just blaming it on whoever designs planes to fit as many people as possible into them. But the
jerks. The jerks design planes that way.
Yes, the underseat storage in the aisle seat is pretty small. The underseat storage in the middle seat looks a little bigger, but there's also this weird thing that everything plugs into. I think it's the seat power and all of the other wiring that goes into the seats now comes into that thing. So it takes up a little bit of that space. And then the biggest space is actually the window. Because the way the fuselage is, it's actually curved right by there, so you have a little bit of extra space for storage, not really for feet, because if you're tall on a plane, I'm sorry, you're screwed. But and this does nothing to alleviate that. They're still just cramming people into the plane for cheaper. I mean, it's an interesting way to get more people on the plane that isn't overselling every flight. But it doesn't guarantee they're not doing that either, so I'm not sure if this is better.
American Airlines good luck seats.
Planes don't. And which is sad because I'm probably going to be on one next week. I think it may even be American Airlines. We'll see. We're going to move from one facet of air travel to another. We've talked about this on the show a while ago in insert episode here regarding supersonic air travel coming back. There was a group that wanted to restore a Concorde jet, if I'm remembering right, and then do limited flights transatlantic. But there's another company, and they're called Boom, as in Sonic Boom. And they are trying to make a commercial jet that will do supersonic flights for the price of like business class seats. So it's already out of the reach of like normal mortal people. Also, there are only going to be 45 people on each of these planes. The laws of supply and demand are going to hit this one pretty hard. But it does sound really interesting. They are going with a completely different design. They're not using the Concorde. They're not upgrading, you know, like a more traditional jet to try and fly supersonic. So they have designed their own jet, and it went through wind tunnel testing, and that has just cleared. So that's all good to go, and they're going to start making a prototype plane, which will actually fly. I think it's going to be one third the size is what they're shooting for. But they're going to build what they call a demonstrator jet, and then fly it rather than doing wind tunnel testing. I think it would be really cool to do supersonic travel. I think that should be a thing. That or what is it? Hyperloop travel, if that ever gets pulled together.
I'd rather have Hyperloop than supersonic planes.
Really?
Yeah.
You'd rather be vacuum tubed away versus flying in a jet?
It's the closest I'd be to being in an artillery shell, right? I guess they both kind of would be that way.
Yeah. They're going real fast. Anything to make that aspect of it shorter. Of course you'd still end up, you know, in traffic for like 2 hours to get to the one place that would let you fly, you know, supersonic or whatever. But it's neat. I'm glad transport is still advancing. I don't want a flying car. I would be very, very worried about a flying car. I like just cars. Cars are fine. Self-driving cars, we've said on the show numerous times, are a thing. I think there are lots of ways that people can get from place to place. We really got to figure out that matter transport thing, though. Someone has to get on that. Also in the air, we're going to talk about some drones that DARPA is funding. And when we say DARPA and drones in the same sentence, usually it's really bad. It's those crazy robot dogs, or, you know, some super death machine that flies somehow. But no, this is actually an interesting project. So apparently it's the melding of two projects, one of which was to create a biodegradable like flying package, essentially. And so they were able to make essentially a big cardboard paper plane that you can put stuff in, that like supplies of, you know, food or medicine or medical things, like, you know, blood, plasma, or something that you would have to, you know, airdrop to a place. And this is a way to get it there a little more securely. So their thought was first to make something that could be, you know, just dropped from a plane, and it would, you know, glide down to where it needed to be. And then they added in some technology from another project, which was to make electronics that would also biodegrade. So the whole package can biodegrade, but it has like a little bit of avionics and guidance. So it can like turn at a waypoint and tell where it is and stuff like that, you know, potentially avoid things. It sounds really interesting. And then when it gets to its destination, people take it apart, they drop all the, you know, the payload out of it. And then because it's mostly cardboard, it just, you know, degrades over time like anything else. So interesting project. It actually does not appear to be a, you know, a weapon of any sort, at least not in any way that I could tell. I'm sure you could use it as one. But, you know, it's like you would use it to deliver something and then it biodegrades, so there's no trace that they delivered it, except I don't know. It just looks neat. It's the picture in the show notes, which we post every show. You can always go back and you know, fill in the gaps. We always talk about the things, and being a you know, an audio medium, I mean, visual stuff really just doesn't work. So pictures, if you'd like pictures, go to the show notes for this show, and you can see the little cardboard plane that they put together. How fun must that be to make? I make cardboard planes. I make paper planes for the government. That is a job description, which probably will get a lot of use in the next 4 years. Moving from one kind of autonomous thing to another, or at least robotic thing, we're going to talk about a robot that some researchers have put together or prototyped for people with at risk of heart failure. Apparently there's some large number. It was there's a lot of people in this article that they said were at risk for heart failure. And the normal way that is dealt with is essentially the blood is offloaded to a pump that's separate in that they implant in you, or is otherwise connected to you. And then if your heart is not strong enough to pump blood, you know, through your system, they implant a pump that will do it for you until you can either get a full heart transplant or have an artificial heart potentially. It's one of those things where it's like medical science has not gotten all the way there yet. There are different ways, like pacemakers, to control the rate of your heart. There's artificial hearts, which are only workable in certain situations, but the gap that the scientists wanted to fill, they are prototyping a silicone sleeve that has air bladders in it, and it can be wrapped around the heart, and then all of the air bladders and chambers are electronically controlled, And then when they want to, they fill the bladders with air, and it kind of squeezes the heart, and they can do that, you know, or they have enough control over it to do it so it matches the, you know, auricles and ventricles of the heart, the chambers of the heart, to make it work. And the interesting thing about this is because they're not introducing any new tubing, they're not introducing anything that can clog, which is what often happens when you have like an artificial heart or artificial things in there, and you have to be on blood thinners and things like that. Instead, because this is essentially just augmenting the heart's muscles and not touching the blood at all, it's a lower risk for the patient. And so they've tested this with pig's hearts, and there's a little I think it's a GIF on the link of like the little sleeve like squeezing the heart, and they have a little a tube that goes straight up to show the effective pressure of that synthetic heartbeat pumping, and you can see the liquid, you know, kind of jumping in that chamber. The first thing I thought when I saw this of something like squeezing, you know, their heart is I immediately go to Temple of Doom. Yes, exactly. Yeah, so hopefully they dial in the squeeze pressure correctly.
And that they don't mix this with some sort of artificial intelligence.
Yes.
We don't need Skynet with its hands on everybody's hearts.
Yeah, I agree. I think a simple, you know, the simple timing chip would be fine for for heartbeats. But I like the idea of it assisting the existing muscles rather than completely replacing it. I think it's meant to be a temporary thing still. Like, it wouldn't be something that you could use for the duration of your life, or at least from that point on. It's meant to be kind of stopgap until like an actual heart, you know, can be transplanted. Which, you know, in there's more people that than want hearts than are donors for them. So, medical science marching on with that one. I think that one sounds you know, interesting and could actually kind of do some cool stuff. Moving over to technology, and actually, you know, sort of bringing some technology back to life, or keeping in that theme. Instead, we're bring some people are bringing technology back to life. So specifically, LavaBit, which gained notoriety a while ago for being a secure encrypted email server or service. That went away. All of a sudden, it was just like gone. And one of the most notorious clients of LavaBit was Edward Snowden. And the reason the server went away was because the various government agencies were trying to get into LavaBit in order to see Snowden's mail and things like that and other things. And so they had created an order to get the SSL keys from the proprietor of LavaBit, which their encryption system was based on a set of SSL keys that they held. And so rather than give up the SSL keys, he just shuttered the site and closed everything down. And so he has since re-architected the way the email is encrypted, so even if he was compelled to give a key, it would not work because he's using, you know, more rigorous protections about how keys work, probably asymmetric, or rather symmetric. Yes. I always do that wrong. Symmetric keys, public key, private key, that kind of thing. It's also based on the darkmail standard, which we talked about in insert episode here, which also obscures the metadata around the email. So normally when you encrypt mail, the mail is encrypted, but you can still see the from, the to, the sent from, all of the servers in the chain as the messages are passed through the internet. And so you can you know, tell with the metadata a lot of information, who's talking to whom, you know, how often they talk, things like that. So this, the standards that are built in obscure all of that, so it's a lot more secured, essentially, which I think is really interesting. If you absolutely need something like that, that service is back on. They have a pretty good track record. Edward Snowden has said that he would reactivate his account, but he would still need to see more about if it would, if it's, you know, how well protected it is, given that they did get, like I said, a government order to turn over all the keys for how it works. But, you know, securing mail, I think, is a thing. We've talked about it in the past. I have sent all of 3 PGP messages in my entire life, unfortunately. So it's a thing, but it's not that easy to do. And I think a service like LavaBit goes a long way into making those kinds of things easier. That Open Whisper Systems, which makes the Signal app for iOS and Android, and they also make, I think it was called Redphone. I might be wrong, but that was the, it was for calling and encrypting the voice traffic. So like the, you know, the carriers can't listen in on any of your calls and stuff like that. This kind of stuff is interesting and should be allowed and should be used by people that need to use it without fear of being snooped and stuff like that. I think you know, there is still a right to some privacy in the world, as much as you know, the internet does to touch anything and everything. People should still be able to talk to people, you know, reasonably, in my opinion. moving on and over, I think we're going to roll right over into something near and dear to our hearts, the San Francisco Sketchfest shows. Those were the last 2 weeks. I think it still has another week to go in it.
Yep.
And we talk about it every year for a number of reasons, but really the big one is we just like comedy, and it's so... there are very few other things where you have this critical mass of comedians and shows and the diversity of shows. I mean, it's called Sketchfest, but you know, it's not just sketch comedy, it's stand up and long form improv. You know, it's interviews with you know, various people in the industry, podcasts. And that's really the big reason. I mean, most of the reason I think that we started the podcast was we were kind of inspired by a podcast that we saw live at Sketchfest, however many years ago that was.
An episode that never actually got released.
Really?
Yeah, no, they never. I don't think they ever released that episode.
Huh. Oh, that's funny.
Because Dan Harmon is out of control.
Yeah, that's true. If I'm remembering right,
he was hammered.
But we saw them do the Nerdist podcast live, and then we you know, had a couple talks about it over some scotch, I think, and it was like, how hard is it to do one of these things? And it's like, I don't know. It doesn't seem that hard. And now look at us, 214 episodes later.
Yeah, I would say the two biggest influences on me wanting to start the podcast were The Nerdist and Doug Loves Movies.
Yeah.
And I got to see The Nerdist again this year, and Doug Benson and some other comedians interrupt 50 Shades of Grey.
Oh my God.
Which I would say is the only way I ever would watch that movie. it is terrible. But that, I probably laughed the most at that event of all the events I went to.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I really needed a laugh, especially because the show we saw was the day after the presidential inauguration, and so it was nice to kind of get that level of release. The other show that we saw that day was the was Outtake-O-Rama. So they three actors, three voice actors from Futurama, Billy West, John DiMaggio, and Maurice LaMarche. They got together, and they've been doing this show a little while, where they will do different voice things. I mean, they're all three like amazing voice actors, but what and they have impressions of all sorts of people. And one of the things that they all do is they reenact outtakes, famous kind of voiceover outtakes. And so there are tapes floating around from years ago of people playing pranks on each other, or, you know, screwing up when trying to record something. And you know, they're kind of, they were passed around. This was pre-internet, because it was all physical media tapes, and they would just kind of pass them between each other and laugh. And so they used to do impressions of these. They, you know, they liked them that much, and they turned that into a show. So that was great to watch.
And I've now been able to find pretty much all of the bits that they did. They're on YouTube, so mm-hmm. you can see Barry White outtakes, or listen to, which I highly recommend, or drunk Orson Welles trying to do a champagne commercial. I think I watched that video like 12 times today.
One of the greats, for sure.
and it was great at the Nerdist podcast getting to see Nathan Fillion of Firefly.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
He was real close.
And I don't think we bring up these shows to necessarily just talk about how great they were. It's so people don't know this stuff exists. Like, every year I still hear people who don't know about Sketchfest.
Yeah.
And so I highly recommend checking it out. The shows are affordable, and I'd say they're between 15 and 40 bucks for the most part.
Yeah.
And they're cool venues. There's lots of different things out there, different styles of stuff. I mean, there's this festival season saw the Nerdist podcast, this Outtake-O-Rama, seeing comedians make fun of movies, Doug Benson, Eugene Merman's podcast. And they do a great event that's actually probably one of the cheaper events at the California Academy of Sciences. They do a nightlife event where they have a lot of different stuff there. They had some of the guys from Mystery Science Theater there. They had stand-up comedians. I saw an improv troupe doing an improv of season two of Stranger Things, which was brilliant. If you like comedy, it's a great, great festival.
Yeah. And I think there's still a week left. It'll be interesting to see what, is still available, but, it comes around real quick. I remember when they announced the shows, I want to say it was right around Thanksgiving.
They usually like end of November, beginning of December, they'll announce the shows, and then the next week tickets will go on sale.
Yeah.
So when you have Christmas season coming around, keep an eye out for that stuff a couple months ahead of time.
Yeah. This year I saw for the second time Jeff Goldblum and the Mildred Snitzer Orchestra, which is his jazz band. So he plays piano with a jazz band like weekly in LA, and for reasons that, you know, only make sense in the world of comedy, they do that show as part of Sketchfest.
And you didn't just get to see him, did you?
Oh no, he it was at the Swedish American Hall, which is a pretty cool venue. I've seen quite a few Sketchfest things there, and some concerts, but the one notable thing about the venue is that there's no backstage. So when the band's done, they just kind of walk out with the crowd. And so the show ended, and as people were leaving, they kind of hung out at the stage for a little while, and then they started walking out. And Julie and I were in the aisle that he decided to walk out on. So as he's walking out, he's like shaking people's hands. And so I turn around and I'm like, Julie, look. And so as we both turn around, he's like right in front of me. So I'm like, oh my God, thank you. And like, he shook my hand, and then Julie, who is a huge Jeff Goldblum fan. I can't go into how big of a fan she is, but she turns around and got a hug, and it was like amazing. It was fine. let's see what else. It's exactly as you were saying at the you know, about the variety of shows that are there. It's really, really wide, and you're right. There are a lot of people that just, they don't hear about it, and then they go to one show, and then it's like, oh my god, there's all these shows, and there really are. it's like three straight weeks where almost every day there's a bunch of shows, and on Fridays and Saturdays it's just tons and tons and tons. And so it's a really cool setup. Definitely more people should go. Maybe one day we'll get a live taping of our podcast connected to that. Maybe.
I wouldn't count on it.
Well, if you would like to come to a live recording of our podcast, maybe even be on the show, let us know. You can always tweet at us or Facebook us or say hi as we're, you know, flying around the country and whatnot. I love meeting folks who listen to the show. It's mostly because they're already friends of mine. So so it's really great to see my friends is what I'm trying to say. But if you, you know, if you have ideas for the show, or if you would like to be on, you know, we're real easygoing. We love having guests. It's a thing. So yeah, just put it together and we'll have you on the show. It's a done deal. And let's see. I think the one other thing I wanted to talk about on the show is the Women's March, which was the kind of, it started out as just the Women's March in Washington, but something like hundreds of sister marches were also kind of planned on that day, the day after, the Saturday after Inauguration Day. You know, around the country, but also around the world, there were a number of kind of related protests and marches. There was even one in Alaska, and they showed footage of people like trudging through the snow, like blizzard snow. And yet there were millions of people that participated. It was like the largest single day of protest in, I want to say, U.S. history, maybe even bigger than that. But not one arrest. Like, that's amazing and something that is really fantastic. I hope we can have some folks on the show regarding that. If you were part of, you know, the protests, you know, we were able to get to some of it, but certainly not to the extent of a bunch of people. I'd love to hear your perspectives on it, you know, via Twitter or Facebook, or if you'd like to be on the show, yet another reason. Yeah. I'm just overwhelmed. It was a very kind of big Saturday for me for that. I mean, there were the protests, there was Sketchfest, it was seeing, you know, so many people. So one of the things for the Nerdist show, because we've gone every year, you know, since the podcast inception, it has become kind of an informal podcast meetup for a few of our friends. So that was also really fun to do. So yeah, we should keep recording this show. I think it's good. We at least need to make it through next week.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Brendan, I will see you next week.
Till next time, Alan.